our first guest. As I mentioned earlier in the show, our guest today is Claude Berube. Claude, he teaches at American Government, Naval History, Campaigns, Elections, Terrorism, Emergent Naval Warfare, and what really ties in well here and wraps it all up in a nice bow, Maritime Security Challenges at the U.S. Naval Academy. He's worked in naval research and development, acquisition, intelligence program. He's also worked for two senators on Capitol Hill. He's a good bipartisan staffer, one Democrat and one Republican. He's also the co-author of two books on naval history and the article of over 20 articles. He's also a lieutenant commander in the Naval Reserve, and he has some recent experience in this area as a reservist, where he deployed in 2004-2005 with ESG-5, where he participated in maritime interception operations, humanitarian relief operations in Sumatra, and also anti-piracy off Somalia. And as a side note, if you're interested in what type of books he writes, if you go on Blog Talk Radio to the show page for Episode 2, we have a link there to one of his books, A Call to Sea, about Captain Charles Stewart of the USS Constitution. And let me bring Claude up here. And I know you can hear me right now, Claude, so good afternoon.
To you, Eagle One and Galron. Good to talk to you guys.
Hey, good to hear from you again. Hey, before we dive right into the piracy problem, I hope you can indulge me for a moment, Claude. I think you have one of the most important responsibilities in the Navy and what you're doing right now, and that is the care, feeding, and development of the Navy leadership seed corn by being a teacher at the Naval Academy. So if you wouldn't mind, just for 30 seconds or a minute or so, just take a second about and tell us about your midshipman.
Sure. It's a pleasure to do that because this is my fifth year teaching at the Academy. First year, 3 years I was there on active duty, the last two as a civilian. And I got to tell you, out of my 20-odd years of professional experience, this has clearly been the best experience, especially watching them coming as plebes and watching them grow into young officers. A lot of the folks that I've already taught are now overseas or on deployment. I still hear back from them. They are incredibly sharp. They are incredibly creative. And that's one thing I continue to be surprised at every day. In fact, the first day of every semester, we've got our first day coming up here Tuesday, I show a slide of my three teaching principles. The first principle is what I know and you don't know, I'm going to teach you. The second principle is what I don't know, you know, and you know, you're going to teach me. And the third one is what neither of us knows, we're going to learn together. And to be quite honest, I don't think a day has gone by where I haven't learned something from those midshipmen.
Outstanding. Thanks a lot for that. Now, let's bounce right into piracy. And Claude, why don't you give us just a quick shot of where you see us in 2010, and then we'll let Galloran follow that up with a question directly to you. And speaking of questions, just a reminder for everybody, our number, if you want to call in, it's 347-308-8397. And especially for those that would like to talk to Claude, get early on, because if you have questions for him, we'll bring you up first. So, Claude, over to you.
Thanks. Well, I thought I'd bring up just a few key points and tie them into some things that you guys started off with at the top of the hour. First, I'd agree that piracy is comparatively a low-priority national security threat to the United States, and there's a couple of reasons for this. Obviously, we've got obligations elsewhere in Iraq, Afghanistan. But keep this in mind that only about 1% of the commercial ships out there are U.S. flagged. So consequently, there are very few U.S. mariners, and I think this is very quite different from the early 19th century when you had, America truly was a maritime nation. And it's interesting that you brought up Jefferson at the top of the hour, Fabian, because there was something that Jefferson said about piracy. He said he thought we should organize an international task force comprised of all Europeans, European nations whose shipping was being victimized. And to that, John Adams replied that he thought it was a great idea, but it was an idea whose time had not come. And I could talk about that a little later, but it led me to study the possible use of private maritime security companies to supplement U.S. forces. So getting back to that, number one, it's a low priority right now. Number two, piracy is obviously increasing. Past 5 years, especially, I was out there off Somalia about 5 years ago now, when one of the first larger ships was taken. And what that may be a result of is either the U.S. is unable to deal – sorry, I don't want to say the U.S. is unable to deal with it, because if you look at a tactical standpoint, ship by ship, we do pretty well against pirates. You know, those are 18th and 19th century technologies and tactics that we do, and even more modern ones that we can handle pretty effectively. But as a whole, we've got other priorities. So consequently, piracy is expanding, I think. And I think that's one of the reasons why we've got that problem. Third, navies as a whole are unable to contain the problem because we simply don't have enough ships. And I've argued this for a couple of years now, along with the fact that nations have different rules of engagement. For example, one nation may have a catch-and-release program, or most nations may have a catch-and-release program. Some may actually take the pirates and have them prosecuted, as was the case with the Maersk Alabama, where we had one of them, and we've gone ahead to start prosecuting them. So I think those are the three biggest issues. What I see in the future is that if the number of attacks and the financial costs to the shipping companies continue to increase, then we may see more hiring of private maritime security firms, whether those are folks who are located on board as part of defensive measures or as escort ships. And I think you guys have discussed the issue of Yemeni and Tanzanian navies being used as escort ships or being hired out. We can talk about that a little further. So that's the general framework that I see this right now.
Well, let me follow up with that and discuss the it looks like a charter for the African navies to take a security role, which is new. And there does appear to be a trend in the maritime community, the shipping community, to bring security not only on board, but now we're seeing this potential trend of African navies providing some sort of protection with a separate boat. I'm wondering, is this something that we're going to see a lot of in 2010? And are the costs there? Is this cost prohibitive for most companies, or is this something that we're going to see expand because the costs are not, or the costs make sense from an insurance perspective? Do they even factor into insurance?
Claude, you still there? It looks like Claude just dropped off. So, Galen, why don't you hold that thought right now? And I'll tell you what, while we are going to wait for Claude to call back in, we're here if I can unmute him for a second. Claude, how are you?
Great. Sorry about that. It looks like I got disconnected briefly.
No question at all. Did you get the kernel of Galloran's question? Would you like to respond to it?
Actually, if you could repeat it, I caught the first part, but that was it.
Well, I'm curious about your opinion on the trends of private security. We've seen the looks like a charter for the African nations to provide gunboats, and then we're seeing some of the larger shipping companies provide private security teams on the vessels themselves. And I'm curious if you see a trend here and how the trend is going to play out in 2010 when you consider factors like cost in particular, but also does cost factor into insurance? I think that it's unclear whether or not that is the case.
Yeah, that's a good question. I did an article for James Intelligence Review about a year or so ago, and I spoke to a number of shipping companies, and I've been talking to them since, and there has been a shift in the past couple of years on this issue. At first, they were very hesitant to use any sort of armed security aboard because they didn't want to escalate anything at sea. They didn't want to endanger the ship or the crew. But the next phase was to actually have armed security aboard. There has been some effort by some companies, both U.S. and European, to develop a more of a robust escort service with ships. I think probably the most prominent one certainly was what used to be called Blackwater. I'll call them Blackwater here for now. And their ship, the MacArthur. I was on the MacArthur about a year and a half ago, about 2 years ago for the first time, and Last year, I was on there for 2 days to interview the captain, crew, and I spent about 2 hours interviewing Eric Prince, the president and founder of Blackwater, about his intent for Blackwater's Navy. And it was pretty insightful. They were just about to get underway, and they went to the Middle East for a while, but I think their business model may not have been particularly conducive to the shipping companies at that point. There are some other firms that are looking at developing it, but I think if we've seen that piracy has affected shipping companies already to get them into having armed security aboard, I think if we continue to see the path of this increase in piracy over the next couple of years, they may want to start looking at doing more standoff distances using escort ships.
Claude, would you be interested in taking a caller?
Sure, happy to.
From the American Siberia with Pine Trees, area code 904, you're up and welcome to Midreps.
Hi, this is Lee C. from warboaters.org and other sites. I got to start off with a sort of a short sea story that goes to the history of all this, which sort of shows the importance of that I hold with piracy. I almost had one of my ships pirated. That happened to be a Prepo ship, full of ammunition, being towed back to Subic Bay, going through the Straits of Sedimonda. And this was in 1986 or 87, and actually had SEALs fly out from QB and land on the ship to provide it protection. So my association with piracy and merchant ships goes back a pretty long way. I should say that MSC has had at least three or four different iterations of security, i.e. What we now call force protection, on their nucleus fleet ships, both their own ships and long-term charters. So MSC has been contending with this for quite some time. In point of fact, they hosted a ship security presentation a few months ago, which we've heard nothing out of. So that and the fact that I've got a few Mariner friends who are out there sailing around now in that particular point of the neck of the woods, it seems like we should be taking this perhaps a little more seriously. I think it was Gallagher who mentioned that there was nobody really dying from these. There was not a lot of lethality involved with this. Well, perhaps you should count in that the numbers of Somalis who've been trying to emigrate, i.e. be smuggled into Yemen, and don't quite make it due to the smugglers slant pirates that are in that area now covered, Gulf of Aden area. So yeah, I think there's more lethality to this than perhaps some folks should attribute. The cost? Go ahead. I'll just leave it. We'll just go for there. I got a few other points, but see what the folks have to say about that.
Yeah, the Elron was discussing with the lethality to the mariners themselves, and not necessarily to those involved or paying for and involved with human trafficking across the Gulf of Aden from Somalia to Yemen and back and forth, et cetera. It's quite true that there have been very few mariner deaths. There was a captain, I think it was a Ukrainian captain of a ship, a few months ago who was killed. Yeah,
that's correct. It's just a matter of time until mariners, U.S. flag mariners, will be subject to lethal force by these floods at sea.
Claude, this is Vivian weighing in here. I think one thing we may be looking at here is a variation of the CNN effect, where it's not so much how many people are being held for ransom, but what nations those individuals come from. How much do you see as playing into that? And if everybody that's being taken prisoner were all from France and Germany, would there perhaps be a different reaction?
Absolutely. Majority of mariners, and Eagle One can confirm or refute this, but the majority of mariners out there right now are from the Philippines. If I would agree with you that if there were more mariners, U.S. mariners, who were being subject to piracy attacks, then you would see the media be involved on a 24-hour see with the Bama. I think there have been plenty of ships taken. CNN effect. And I'd argue that that.
Okay, I'm going to weigh in here. Unfortunately, Claude, like you broke up there for a second. Let's.
I thought he fell into a well.
Where's Lassie when you need her? Eagle One, why don't you weigh in here for a second? He brought up the topic of the nationality of a lot of the people who are being held captive. And touch on that, if you could, a little bit, not just from a press point of view, but a legal and a social point of view as well, if you could.
Yeah, he's right. The vast majority of the people being held are third world natives, most of them, many of them Filipino. Of course, the Chinese ships that are grabbed are full of Chinese crewmen. We also see Russians, Ukrainians. Hardly any American mariners ply the seas as deckhands anymore, except on the ships that require American flagship, U.S. flagships require American mariners. And that poses a challenge in that we don't want to get anybody killed, and the Philippines are not really in a position to provide any safety for their crews. But it also points out the problem with one of the reasons they don't want to arm merchant ships and merchant. I see the Philippines are beginning to train some of their personnel and some of these people in small arms and other stuff to help fend off pirates. Most part, the ship owners and the captains don't want these crewmen armed. They don't think that that's a very safe condition to operate in.
Yeah, we lost Claude again, so I want to bounce back over to Galvin, give your take on the last comments we made.
Well, I think that the nationality of who the mariners are makes a big difference here in the discussion. The Philippines doesn't have a navy that's going to deploy security forces to the Indian Ocean and protect their mariners. Although there has been discussions that they might look into some limited force protection in that area. Going back to the caller's question, I think force protection is an interesting topic in itself because it raises the question, who should be the force protection groups? Should it be the private security folks that the Navy and Western powers are encouraging the private industry to look into, or should it be some sort of state function to provide force protection for vessels? I think that there's a legitimate discussion there because, as I understand it, U.S. flag ships, for example, are buying insurance from U.S. insurance companies, and when you're talking about the insurance companies, what is their role other than insurance? I mean, it seems like they're charging considerably more money without implementing any sort of security on the front end, so that all of the monetary costs come out of the back end or on top of security that the mariners themselves invest in. So there are a lot of questions regarding who should be the funding agent for force protection. I don't see anything changing as of right now, but all it takes is a few incidents where private security companies act in aggressive manner that gets covered on CNN or Fox News or even in the BBC, and I think that will immediately become a political discussion where I don't think it would be very pretty for the politics of piracy as it stands right now.
Okay, we've got Claude back. So, Claude, do you want to pick up where you dropped off?
Sure. I think the question was about mariners, and the problem. One of the problems is that we're finding the underlying issues is that we don't have a robust commercial industry, commercial shipbuilding industry. But also getting back to something someone wrote on the chat room, how I felt about the Chinese flotillas going in to do anti-piracy operations. And I think that's really important from a far more strategic standpoint, is that if the U.S. alone or with its partners in Europe or wherever are not able to handle this, well, nature abhors a vacuum, and so you're starting to see the Chinese sea legs, if you will, coming on over to the Horn of Africa and taking on a role that has traditionally been American for the past 100 years and the Royal Navy, say, for the 100 years before that. And to follow, just to follow up with what Galeron was talking about with private industry, you know, there was one point that somebody made on one of the blogs this week about Blackwater, that one of their problems may have been that they simply advertised too much, and that would be a good point. What Eric Prince told me during that interview last year, in fact it was last year this month, was that that was actually their intent, because they had been restricted on how much they could discuss their operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. What he wanted to do with the MacArthur was swing the pendulum the other way and show, be as transparent as possible, which is why they were going to have 60 minutes on their ship out in the Middle East for a couple of days. I had arranged to be on for about 4 to 6 weeks as a writer for the Washington Times. So they were trying to be transparent for a specific reason. So just if that's a clarification.
Absolutely. And if you had a second here,
sure.
Our original caller from 904 had a follow-up question for Claude. Go ahead, Erica 904.
Yeah, the cost, we're paying the cost. The price of UN-mandated and MSC Navy-mandated force protection is built into the charter hire of all those vessels with the United States Navy in the form of MSC charters. We're paying it. It's already being paid for. P&I insurance is already something that's paid for in the chartering. So for all the charters that the United States Navy has, they're coming out of the taxpayer's pocket, all those costs. And one might also look at the impact on U.S. flag shipping more in strategic sealift terms. These vessels and the 6,000 mariners that MSC employs are performing a vital sealift function, be it tactical or strategic. So
sure.
These ships are not just merchant mariners. Some of these ships are vital strategic assets.
Understood.
Sure.
I agree.
So where do you see the line being drawn at the merchant ships as people classically see them and MSC, how we can react differently for those two different breeds?
I'm sorry, Kev, who was the question geared toward?
I'm sorry, that was for you, Claude.
Okay. You know what, actually, I'm not sure, to be honest with you. I'm just not sure on that one.
Well, this is Eagle One. I don't think the ships the size of the MSC ships and the speed at which they sail are really at risk from the Somali pirate. What we're looking at here, with the exception of this recent capture of the boat carrying autos, which has an unusual, it remains to be seen why in the world they would go after that one or how they got on board. Most of the time, they're looking for very low freeboard ships that aren't traveling that fast. And that's the ones that they've been, those are the ones they've been successful in grabbing. MSC, with its modernized fleet, really doesn't have any ships that except for the on lease from Maersk, like the Maersk Alabama, which has, you know, does pose some risk. But again, there's cost built into that contract with the Maersk people, I'm sure.
Galeron, did you have something you want to add?
Well, I was going to ask Claude a question. Specifically, how does the flags of convenience for all of these ships factor into this piracy deal? I mean, do we need to take a hard look at flags of convenience as a function of maritime shipping? Because it really is just part of maritime shipping today. When we look at piracy, does it matter? Is that one of the reasons why no one cares?
That is a great point, and you're right. We should be looking at that, because I think what a lot of the shippers have done in the past few decades is shifted away from countries like the United States, which could have offered them protection, but by the same token would have increased their costs. I think the average cost for a shipping company here is about 30 to 40% higher than most other countries in the world. So they've basically rolled the dice by becoming a Panamanian flagged or finding one of the islands in the South Pacific. But with being a Panamanian flag, you're not going to have that Panamanian protection overseas. You're going to rely on the goodwill of the nations that happen to be patrolling in the area.
Well, on that point, does that mean that maybe we shouldn't care because these ships have chosen not to flag U.S.? I mean, if you're Panamanian, is that China's problem these days? I guess would be my question.
I really don't think we can approach it from that perspective. You know, I think it's really easy to say, you know, you haven't gone with us. Well, too bad. But these are mariners, and we have a responsibility in the world to provide assistance when requested, and that's why we'll go in and do these operations. Whether that's us or if it's a British frigate or German or whoever that's patrolling in the area, I think Eagle One could probably speak to this issue of the law of the sea a lot better. But when somebody's calling for help out there, you go and assist them. And in fact, that was going to be one of the problems. I had asked Eagle One about this. We had a discussion a few months ago. Is if you have a private escort ship in the Gulf of Aden that's assigned to commercial ship A, and then ship B issues a distress call, well, what are the legal implications if the escort ship ignores ship B if they're taking care of, you know, client A out there? And that's got to be something that's resolved if there are private escort ships eventually.
Eagle One, you want to take that?
Well, yeah, I passed the buck last time Claude asked me that question. I may pass on it again. It's a hard question. Under international maritime law, you have an obligation to render aid to a ship that's calling for help. But then, as we've seen, the pirates are pretty savvy. They attack one ship, you send off your escort to go respond to their request for help, and then the pirates will attack the ship that the escort just left. You know, that's the challenge, and one of the reasons why I think many people are looking at these private military companies as onboard assets and not necessarily having the escort vessels by themselves. And also, you know, if you look at the military intervention, the most successful intervention have been with the helicopters showing up overhead. That seems to thwart a lot of pirate attacks.
Yeah, I think that folds into a conversation I had. Some of y'all may have read it on USNI blog, where I interviewed the CEO, former Marine special agent, who has a maritime security company. And I think the point also that it's a lot better from a legal point of view, if you have your own private security corporation, ROE, be able to manage things. If you say, hey, I'm on board this ship, as opposed to having a boat that you have to keep going underway and things like that. Up on the blog, we had a question for you coming from one of our readers, listeners from Turkey. And his question was, how does this particular phase of piracy come to an end? Now, can the international community, and I think the answer is no, have the capacity to stay out here forever? When do we get to the point that we can, at least for this stage of the game, declare victory?
That's the question of the decade, I think. There are three primary options you have in dealing with modern piracy, especially off Somalia. Number one is stability on the mainland, which is pretty unlikely. Number two are punitive strikes, which we just don't do those anymore. We did them not only with the Barbary Wars, we did them in Kuala Batu and a few other places in the 1820s and 1830s. But there's a fear of civilian casualties and the resultant public relations fiasco, which can result from punitive strikes. So that we're really left with a policy of containment or deterrence off of Somalia. But again, while it's been effective, say, in the Gulf of Aden, where we've had that sea lane, it's what's
happened is we've seen an increase throughout the Indian Ocean going out 1,000 miles now, which is incredible. So I think right now our only option is containment or deterrence, but I think your guess hits the nail on the head. How long can the coalition or the partnering ships remain on station for this?
And now that we're getting close with a little more than 7 minutes left, I'd like to take one more caller for you. Claude, coming online, area code 703. You have a question for our guest.
Hey, Claude. This is Jerry Hendricks calling.
Hey, Jerry.
I sent a message in earlier about China. My concern, and I'm kind of interested in your thoughts on it, is that the Chinese have used piracy as an excuse to expand outward. And, in fact, we saw a Chinese admiral this past week in a public publication talk about the need to establish forward Chinese resupply bases. And so as we are not there, peer competitors are reaching out now to be there and to establish themselves as a system administrator, to use the Barnettian phrase, in along East Africa. Is that something that we can really just stand by and continue to give them an excuse? What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I think I responded to it, but we may have had a disconnection earlier. I absolutely agree with you. I think when the U.S. has been a world naval power for 100 years now, as the Royal Navy was before it. And I think if we allow other nations to take a role that has been predominantly ours, it demonstrates a potential vulnerability in our overall maritime capability. Now, partnering on occasion is a great idea, but again, having a rising peer competitor come in to fill a role that we've traditionally filled pretty well indicates, I think, some other problems the Navy may have down the road. I know that partnering is a huge concept that's strongly supported, and in some cases it's really important that we do that, but I think we have to look at the long-term game, and in terms of the long-term game, if we can't handle piracy either on our own or with traditional allies, I think we have to recognize what may be coming down in a couple of decades.
I concur. It's definitely an area of vulnerability for us. And I think the one thing the Navy needs to be aware of is this is actually a constitutional requirement actually written into the founding documents. And so I just don't think we can turn a passive eye to it.
Yeah, and I want to follow up also, Jerry, if I could. There's a comment on the chat room about China benefiting from piracy. I think we see a lot of ships out there. I don't know. I'm sure you guys have been out there in the Indian Ocean before. You see ships from all sorts of nations. But illegal fishing, if you go back 15, 20 years, one of the reasons why piracy grew off of Somalia was the problem with failed state, but also the lack of fisheries enforcement. And once that fishing industry went aside because of some of the other nations coming in with illegal fishing, that resulted in a problem as well. So.
Yeah,
Jerry, do you have a follow-up question?
No questions. Thanks a lot.
Sure, Jerry.
This is Eagle One. I should note that as soon as Chinese admiral proposed the bases overseas, the Chinese Defense Department, if you will, Ministry, denied that they wanted to do that. I think it's for them. It's a good learning experience on how to deploy your units.
Sure. Absolutely.
I don't know. I have an observation on that. If you guys paid attention to that leading up to their piracy deployment in 2008, or 2009 rather, they floated this idea to go fight pirates long before they actually went, and they immediately denied it. It's a pattern. The Chinese are actually one country in the world that has a pattern that you can follow, and when they float an idea, it's usually to gauge reaction, to develop their strategic communications within their country for carrying it out eventually. So I see the floating of the idea of a forward base in the Gulf of Aden or Indian Ocean region as something that the Chinese are going to do, likely to do this year or next year. And the reason that it was floated and the mechanism that it is so that they have the deniability, just like they did last year when they said, oh, no, we're not going to send ships to it was in 2008, actually, that we're not going to send ships to Somalia to escort anti-piracy missions, that it's their pattern. I mean, they do things like this.
Right.
And I think at that note, we are about a minute and a half out. Real quick fire here for about 30 seconds or so. Gallagher and Eagle One, you got some last shots you want to take at our guest?
Well, piracy is not going to go away, and you might as well, we're probably going to have to discuss this several times over the course of the next year. So enjoy it.
Yeah, our containment strategy right now is designed to wait for the act of God event, that, like the tsunami that took away piracy in Indonesia and Malaysia. And that's the strategy, unfortunately, that we're looking at now.
So our guest is Ms. Mackenzie Eaglin. She's the research fellow for national security studies at the Heritage Foundation. Just a quick CV I'll give for you on her. It seems like every episode of MidRats, we have to have somebody connected to Maine. We have that again today. In her past, she has been a senior defense advisor to Susan Collins of Maine, and she's diversified a little bit out of Maine. She was also a legislative assistant to John E. Sweeney, a representative from New York. She's been published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Military Times, a series of publications, and other national security papers, magazines. Many papers published, studied up at Carlisle. And she was also the assigned to the Pentagon as a presidential management fellow and wrote speeches for former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard B. Myers. So, Mackenzie, welcome to MidRats.
Thanks for having me. I was glad to hear my intro wasn't, if you really want your ears to bleed, let's talk to Mackenzie.
Well, next time you come on, we'll hit you a little harder. When I first found out about an opportunity to bring you on board, and again, thank you very much for coming on board to kind of give us all an opportunity to discuss the QDR earlier than we're supposed to, but that's okay. When I saw that you were from the Heritage Foundation, my head tilted a little bit, because I think when most people think of the Heritage Foundation, they think of economic issues, maybe domestic policy issues. Tell us a little bit about what you do in the national security arena at the Heritage Foundation, and in a broader sense, what the Heritage Foundation is doing in the national security arena.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me. I really do feel like I'm in the presence of giants. I've learned a lot listening to all three of you and admire you very much, all of you. You know, Heritage is, you're right, known primarily for domestic policy issues, but we're about half and half. Foreign policy, domestic policy focus. We're the largest think tank in the country, one of the largest, I think, in the world. We're the most broadly supported public policy institute. We're not Democrat or Republican. We're nonpartisan, but we are conservative. And, so we believe in, conservative principles as the foundation for any of our analysis. We have about 600,000 members, kind of like the Obama campaign, where checks under $1,000 primarily. Don't have major endowments, don't take major contract money, definitely no government funds. We've been around since the early 70s and have an operating budget of $60 million a year. Our defense team is pretty robust, I think, although we certainly can never cover all the issues. And again, we examine everything from regional to functional, department-wide and interagency issues on anything you can think of.
Great. And was there anything in the last half hour that we were discussing when you're looking at the QDR and coming forward, is that you saw really as a primary issue from a Navy point of view that you hear being discussed inside the Beltway?
Well, I do want to, of course, give Gallagher kudos, because he's right, absolutely right about two points. The Navy doesn't have a long-term strategy for ballistic missile defense yet, and in part I think that's because the department writ large lacks that strategy. And SM-3 is put your money where your mouth is, where everything's going to be at in 2011. And, the QDR, as you know, we see these every 4 years, and they really can be pivotal documents in some ways. In other ways, they're, for practical utility, they're often shelved immediately. It just depends on what you're using it for. But, in large part, this strategy is it's a justification of the 2010 president's budget request, not even the one coming over tomorrow for 2011. And we all know last year's budget request was an extension of the National Defense Strategy. I mean, I haven't seen a lot new here for the Navy. A lot of the recommendations were in the operational weeds, so to speak. A couple helos here and a new J-STARS there and a couple additional F-18s. But, I mean, this wasn't sort of a wide-ranging next-generation look, which by law the QDR is supposed to do. It was obviously very heavily focused on the present. So if you look at today and what the Navy is doing, and I think this is implicit in some of the remarks you were making earlier, it's just a linear, projection forward. It's a status quo.
There was nothing there that really caused me to back up and go, whoa, look at that. Gowron, did you have a question for McKinney?
Yeah, I was going to ask if you see anything in this QDR that says, yeah, this is going to be influential. Usually, like you said, a QDR is used for justification or ignored depending upon somebody's agenda. And a lot of people are talking about the QDR's release, yippee, hooray. What is influential here if there's no statutory aspect to the QDR? I mean, there's no statutory requirements that actually get directed. It's just, do we just go back and look at the budget and see what's coming, or how do we look at this?
Well, it's a great point. I mean, having followed defense policy and worked for, of course, these policymakers for 12 years now, the QDR. Here's what's funny. It's not going to answer any of the questions that every DOD, testifier gave before posture hearings last year. Remember, every difficult question was, well, we'll tell you the answer in the QDR. It isn't even going to come close to answering all the questions. And as far as looking forward, like I said, it is not a visionary document by any means, and it's certainly not strategic in that it focuses on the out years, the 10 to 15 years from now where we want to be. It's really just a projection forward of our legacy fleets in many ways. But, yes, when it comes to actual what's to take note of in this strategy, my answer is the 2011 budget and, to a smaller extent, the FYDP, which we didn't have last year along with the 30-year shipbuilding plan. But it's all about where are the dollars and where are the planned dollars. And for questions like, ballistic missile defense, the future of the new third site, for example, and everything else that's going to matter to the Navy, for me, the answers are in the 2011 budget. They're not in this document.
Eagle One.
Yeah, I had a chance, McKenzie, to go back and look at one of your October articles about the one of the failings of the QDR, which seems to be that the new one focuses on a one war construct, and you argued in favor of the QDR focusing on a two war construct. Could you go through that a little bit?
Sure. We started the QDR process, and the Congress started it in the late 90s, and ever since, for the last 15 years, give or take, the department has sized and shaped the forces and all the military departments around the ability to be able to fight and win, two major theater wars, give or take roughly at the same time, overlapping nearly simultaneously, et cetera. And, this QDR makes a big, splash, or it thinks it does, by dropping the two major theater war construct and saying, it's the world's too complicated and the threats are too unknown, so we're just going to basically need to just do everything. All the last QDRs didn't do what I call the kitchen sink, told the military to do everything. And, every QDR since its inception has basically added missions to the Department of Defense, and by extension, just reality, i.e. The 90s and then, of course, post 9/11. But yet we've consistently been paring back overall force structure in terms of quantitative in general for the department. And this QDR is not going to take us down any different track. My concern about dropping the 2MPW construct, the long-held construct, is that this is one area, back to Gawron's question, where there could potentially be a gasp, but it won't be felt for 5 years, because this is something that everybody knew and understood, and this new muddied kitchen sink approach where we're definitely taking it off the table. And if you look at the set of scenarios this QDR plans for, the only real major contingency it ever calls for is a medium-sized contingency. Well, I would call elements of Iraqi freedom a medium-sized contingency, particularly up front. Even Afghanistan at certain points, taking things like Desert Storm as a major operation, as a yardstick here, just to give people vague references, you know, being able to do one medium contingency really truly sets the U.S. back, and it will further, what it will seek to do is in the future it allows an administration to cut force structure and justify it based on what this strategy says we need to do, and that's what concerns me.
Now, Mackenzie, the point you just brought up reminded me of something with the dangers when you come out and you build things about one medium conflict. Because you remember, especially in the build-up to 2003, in the invasion of Iraq, there was a lot of concern. It's like, well, we've got a little bit of stuff going on in Afghanistan, and now we're throwing so much that we have available in Iraq. Boy, that sure opens the door for another player to do something aggressive in a military manner, because we just don't have the capability to respond to anything else. And I think that would definitely open the door when you have force structure brought down to a certain level, that when you reach a situation where nations find themselves where they have to commit their forces, when you do that, you've pretty much announced, we're tapped out, we're Winchester.
I couldn't agree more. You know, the only real place Ms. QDR looks forward into the future in any high-end conflict is what, you know, the anti-access section, which of course would heavily rely on Navy capabilities to respond. And, you know, it seems like any of the new major next-generation high-end conflict capabilities will come at all, if at all, in a follow-on study for power projection. Well, all of us know the outcome of studies in the department. They never recommend more force structure, and it's really just a kick the can down the road kind of approach to answering difficult questions. But the problem is that with QDR starting behind the curve for exactly what you said, where we are today, the U.S. never really possessed the capability to conduct two high-end overlapping conflicts in the first place. We can do what we can do today, which is two medium-range contingencies overlapping today, but to then project forward and say, well, we might need all of this for an anti-access scenario, but yet propose not really investing in the capabilities required to do that, you're not only starting behind the curve, it further sets us back when we know the procurement cycles for next-generation systems of about a decade.
And we have a caller. O'Gallaghan, do you have a follow-on before we go to the caller?
Yeah, I was going to ask, you had previously written a suggestion, I guess it was early in 2008, right when the QDR process started, to create an independent panel that would review the findings of the QDR. And Congress seemed to like that idea, and they created a panel similar to what you had recommended, but they allowed Gates to appoint, I guess, the lead. And it's a bipartisan panel and all of that. Do you still see that need, and can you kind of outline what that recommendation was, what you have expectations of this panel doing?
Sure. Yes, the Congress ultimately came up with a hybrid panel. You know, it's known as an independent panel, and basically it's designed to offer a critique of the QDR and take an outside look, meaning people who are not on a .gov email or government payroll or at an FFRDC, and allow true independent outsiders to examine the QDR and all of the scenarios and even classified material that goes into feeding into this very short document. We all know there's thousands of supporting pages here. And to go through all that data and decide what are the gaps in what they recommend, what are the gaps in what the law demands the QDR do in general, which there are many, as I've already outlined, and offer that report to Congress as an alternative assessment. I see its importance as even more than a year ago when I was recommending this legislation, because there really hasn't been a rigorous defense debate about the future. Because the president maintained a holdover Secretary of Defense who based all of his major programmatic decisions last year on an NDS issued in a previous administration based on foreign policy guidance of the last president, the department and its decisions and congressional buy-in has been on autopilot. So this is really the only time we're going to see a fair, full, and open debate on this president's defense priorities, which is really, you know, of course, the secretary's. And they're ripe for critique and questioning because so much is being done, so many decisions are being made that are permanent and irreversible. in the department right now, and they're being done in a blink and without any debate because there are so many happening at once. Everything from major programs to things like the shift in the third site to things on the ground in current operations. It's high time for an independent look at this, and like I said, a wide open debate that includes people outside the department who are not subject to non-disclosures and all the other requisites therein.
Absolutely, because you're exactly right, Mackenzie. They are flooding the zone right now with changes. And something that we talked about before we went on the air between the panel is the tapes, the recorded clips. I'll come into the 21st century and call it recorded clips. That came from that subcommittee meeting. Three out of the four people there really could not speak their mind out front, you know, from the Congressional Budget Office and the Congressional Research Service. They were quite limited in doing that. What I'd like to do at this point is give everybody a reminder that you're listening to MidRats, and in addition to our normal panel, we have as our guest Mackenzie Eaglin, the Fellow on National Security Studies at the Heritage Foundation, and we have a caller on the line, area code 904. Do you have a question for Mackenzie?
Are you going to be seeing a lot of, you think we'll be seeing a lot of early DCOMs shrinking of the current fleet?
Okay, early DCOMs.
Yes, thank you. I'm getting used to this new format, so excuse me if I'm cutting you off. Well, we've been seeing that for the past couple of years, particularly for the Navy and the Air Force, because there isn't enough funding for maintenance. Everybody wants to extend the service life and keep, you know, shifts in the fleet longer. I'm a big proponent of that. It's a lot more inexpensive than building, you know, new ships, and the Navy can get more bang for its buck. But let's be honest, the SVN account is just too small for everything the nation's asking the Navy to do. I do think we'll see a reprieve from the mass retirement DCOM, however you classify it, whether it's ships or aircraft, in 2011, but not necessarily over the five-year Pentagon budget, which is concerning. But I think that the leadership understands and recognizes what they can get for, you know, for a few investment dollars up front in the Navy force structure in particular this year. So thankfully we'll see a slowdown, but I don't know how long it'll last.
Well, that leads me to my second point. A lot of this deferred repair work has ended up costing the Navy a hell of a lot more money. Part of my job is to go out and conduct inspections for my company to write up reports. And then comes the negotiating part, and the government says, well, we don't want to do this, we don't want to do that, but we need to do this. And I tell them, look, if you do this now, while we're all set up on the job, you're going to drop automatically 40% of the cost of doing it. If we come back in 6 months and do it, you can attack that 40% back onto it. Do you understand what I'm saying? Yeah, I know, but we don't care. And in 4 months, we're back because now instead of being a thin deck, you got a hole in the deck and water's coming through it. I see it day in and day out. But yet they turn right around and do silly stuff like replace doors that work perfectly fine and all they need is adjusting. I mean, there's no sense, rhyme, or reason to it.
You know, I think one of the things he's hitting on, Mackenzie, is there was a little bit of discussion in late last year about focusing a bit more as the realization of, occasionally I derisively call it the Tiffany Navy, that if you only have a fixed budget and each hull costs a lot, you're not going to get many ships. So back to the future, try to bleed that out a bit, whether they're really putting enough money forward to be able to back up on the waterfront what they would like to do on extending ship life inside the budget?
Well, I think that the real answer is very difficult to grapple with, which is, you know, a fixed top line and how truly tight money is within the department and how much the Navy and the Air Force have taken a hit as bill payers for the Army since 9/11, because you've generally had people, it's hard to explain to people who aren't like all of us listening and talking today because we follow defense issues, but to the American people, you know, they see since 9/11 defense budgets have risen. Well, yeah, but we've also been obviously heavily engaged in Iraq and Afghanistan coming off an entire decade of underinvestment called the 1990s of the procurement holiday and cutting the force by one-third. So we went into 9/11 with a force inadequately sized to do everything we're asking it to do in this decade and the next one. So then you take that and you add to it, you know, growing top lines. But when you look at the core defense budget, which funds the peacetime military, the military also for the future, your current military is, you know, primarily funded in supplemental spending. And what you have is a fiscal situation that's just not pretty. And the Navy has felt this just as much as the Air Force. And it really, there are no good answers except that there should be more leadership from the Navy. I've not seen a CNO come out in the last 3 years and advocate for a higher top line, for example, for the service, for to meet whatever these priorities are there, including maintenance and extending service life, et cetera, fixing the fighter gap, whatever the issues are. Instead, they're just taking it. And I think real leadership demands you sometimes say what's politically inconvenient or difficult, and we haven't really seen that.
Exactly. Very good point. Eagle One, did you have something for?
Yeah, I've got a quote here. I'm going to start off with from Anthony Cordesman and Fitzgerald from their 2010 Quadrennial Defense Review. This is a quote. Like all the other services, the Navy showed a critical lack of top-level leadership. It did not include a 30-year shipbuilding plan, which outlines its long-term plans in its fiscal year 2010 budget request, stating it would wait until after the QDR is complete. Without defined future force plans or procurement goals, it's clear that several issues that need to be addressed in the upcoming review, including the future of amphibious landing capabilities, the role of naval unmanned combat aerial vehicles, and the overall mix between ships designed for littoral environments and the blue water surface combatants, are not being addressed. And along with that, let me add there's a question here from Saturn V who asks about the effect of the QDR on the Navy's cooperative strategy for the 21st century sea power. Now, would you care to comment on that, McKenzie?
I would like to comment in general about, you know, where this QDR is falling short. And in fact, the purpose of the QDR is prepare for future likely conflicts. That's what's in the law. I'm speaking broadly here, of course. And this QDR pretends that the role of the QDR is to provide for a four-second fight today's conflicts, and the purpose is the opposite. And this affects all of these things you just raised. And I'm familiar with Dr. Cordesman's interesting insights, and he's often right about a lot of his criticisms of the QDR. What happens is it leads to things like outcomes that we saw in this document, and which we'll probably see in the budget request as well, whether it's 2011 or over the five-year plan. But then you perpetuate certain myths there, you know, when you start from that as your assumption. You pretend that the legacy systems that we have are adequate, not because they are, but because the authors of the document possibly never intend to build, you know, robust numbers of new generation platforms. It pretends that legacy systems can be sustained at less than their actual cost because the real funds won't be there when we need them for things like maintenance. And it focuses on the treats, for example, riverine squadrons that the Navy should have because it can't justify its view of the force, just dropping the two major theater war constructs.
Gowan?
Yeah, I've got about 15 things flying through my head after that comment. You touched on riverine. I'm looking at the force structure numbers for the Navy in the QDR, and it looks like they have basically taken, for example, 88 cruisers and destroyers. Well, if you count the one DDG-51 funded last year, that would create 88, basically 85 Aegis plus three DDG-1000s. And you look at the numbers for the smaller combatants, and that almost imitates the number of frigates that are there. Is the current force structure sufficient to go forward? Because that's kind of what the QDR implies. Did the QDR miss on this? Just trying to get your take on that.
Sure. I think we're starting behind the eight ball, because that's basically what this QDR does, is it restates current force structure. There's nothing novel or visionary about it. And like I said, it basically linearly projects that forward. You know, 88 surface combatants, my God, that's the 313 ship fleet plan already. What is new about this force structure? But yes, given the additional requirements it's adding on to the department, you guys were referencing, for example, the multitude of humanitarian assistance, building partnership capacity, forward presence, a lot of the things the military is doing now, but even in greater numbers. You know, basically what this QDR says to me is we're going to do the major operations we've been doing since 9/11 plus all the small-scale contingencies we did in the 90s, all at the same time. That's kind of where this QDR is heading. And it's saying legacy, current force, when I say legacy, I mean the stuff on the books today, current force structure will carry that out, you know, adequately. And I think your premise is exactly correct. Current force structure isn't even enough to do what we want it to do today, much less tacking on 1990s-like missions, because, again, we started 2001 with a force one-third smaller than it was at the end of the Cold War, and that alone wasn't big enough to do Iraq and Afghanistan, much less everything else.
You know, McKenzie, you brought up a point earlier. You know, I tapped into my inner Asperger's syndrome and did a little word count on that pre-decisional draft, because words mean things and they often advertise what you're emphasizing. And the comment you said that this really isn't what we've seen at this point, at least, isn't really answering the mail or looking forward, because when you look at how many times it mentions Iraq 55 times, it mentions Afghanistan 60 times. I guess, you know, that's the war we're at. That's kind of expected. But what you don't see, Somalia, Yemen, or Sudan, Somalia and Yemen, not once. Sudan is mentioned once. China, 10. Russia, 4. Iran, 5. North Korea, 3. And some of our best allies, Japan, only gets a mention of 4. The United Kingdom only gets mentioned once. Even Europe versus Asia, they only talk about Europe 11, Asia, all Eurasia 16 times. But where do you see us being able to take the argument forward in the 2 minutes we have left here to try to bring this discussion looking towards the future?
Well, this QDR is basically recommending a bunch of non-answer, lofty recommendations when it comes to the future. It's really leaving it all very open-ended, which for me means you're opening yourself up for more cuts in force structure, because that's what happens to QDRs. This QDR leaves our security largely in the hands of others by assuring the readers that agreements that may or may not come to fruition after review and dialogue. It says DOD will deepen relationships with other nations and private firms to, you know, work in space capabilities. We're not going to build it ourselves, but we're going to convince others to share their stuff. That's a wing and a prayer strategy. Then the DOD, another where's the beef kind of recommendation, it says the U.S. and partners will consult on policies that can deter aggression under new circumstances. So we're going to face down high-end adversaries with diplomacy, treaties, agreements, and building partnership capacity. But back to Gawron's point, the anti-access threat exists today, and our force structure is already inadequate. So it's not answering these questions, and it's pinning our hopes on our friends and allies, which we're definitely marginalizing in the document, which is the greatest irony.
And I think you may have just hit on the tagline for the response to the QDR that parallels the pre-decisional draft that we had to look at. Where's the beef? And the 1 minute we have left, first of all, McKenzie Eaglin from the Heritage Foundation, wanted to thank you very much for coming on for a guest. And if you feel like we treated you all right, I think sometimes down the road, if we have a chance, maybe we could bring you on again.
Please. It's my pleasure and honor, so thank you.
Excellent. And a quick reminder there for everybody, this Wednesday we're going to have a special on MIDRATS on Wednesday at 1700 Pacific Standard Time for Byron and Mayport. That would be 8 o'clock at night. We're going to have as our special guest the publisher of the United States Naval Institute, William N. Miller. The topic will be the Navy Media Ecosystem, and we will be doing it live from the 2010 West Conference and Exposition in San Diego. Thank you very much for the listeners and those on the website, and we'll see you Wednesday and next Sunday as well. Thank you very much. Our guest today to talk about multilateralism at sea and multilateralism in general, we have Hans de Vree. He is from Jane's Defense Weekly and also Radio Netherlands. And following up, we hope to have James S. Robbins. He's from the Washington Times and also National Review Online. Hans de Vree, he is the Netherlands correspondent for Jane's Defense Weekly and the security and defense specialist at Radio Netherlands Worldwide, which incidentally, just like if you want to check what's going on in the continent, there are a couple I stop at. I go to their Spiegel English site and also Radio Netherlands English site are both very good if you want to get a continental view on what is going on. Hans, he received his education from the University of Amsterdam, and before he took on his present responsibilities, he was a web editor, economics, EU, and NATO correspondent for Radio Netherlands World. And Hans, welcome to Midraps.
Thank you.
Hey, just wanted to give you an opportunity here. First of all, for us to say thanks. It's a little bit after 11 p.m. In the Netherlands right now. Now that you finally joined the daylight savings times parade along with everybody else, so it's a little late, but not too late. So we appreciate you taking time to come forward. But this, I think, we would also be missing an opportunity here. Is favorite for a lot of listeners here is Stavridis, who took over in the last year. And Russ Stack, and being that is focused on the EU and focused on NATO, after a fleet of land experts, how are down in having the admiral?
I have a bit difficulty hearing you because your voice gets interrupted something probably on the web or in the phone line. I believe you are talking about the appointment of Admiral Stavridis as Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, highest commander of NATO. It's good to have a Navy guy leading the NATO military forces for a change. Before Admiral Stavridis, we had, of course, General James Jones, who I met several times, interviewed several times. I haven't had yet the opportunity to talk to Admiral Stavridis, but I sure hope this will materialize in the future.
He, whenever you hear him speak, he always talks about how he's up on Facebook and a friend of him on Facebook, so you can try to get in touch with him that way as well. Just as a lead-off here, earlier at the end of last year, you actually got some time underway with a Dutch warship conducting counter-piracy. And I believe the ship you were on was part of the EU naval force, Atalanta. When you look at different forces that are out there doing counter-piracy off of Somalia, you have an EU force. You also had NATO standing naval forces come through there on two occasions in the last year, I believe, in addition to Task Force 150, 151. There, when you strip out Canada and when you strip out the U.S. and Turkey, pretty much the forces that participate in the EU effort and also those forces that you see, whether you're talking about when NATO went through and also ETF 150, 151, you pretty much have similar nations involved. What is a significant difference between a nation deciding that we have a frigate that we can participate for this effort? We will have it either go to the EU force or we will have it go to ETF 150 or 151. What really is the decider then for them to make that point of going one way or the other?
I think the main issue here is to balance efforts between EU and NATO. Often you see the same ships in different roles and flying under or being under different commands. Dutch frigate may at one point be involved in Task Force 150, which is the maritime arm of Operation Enduring Freedom, and then you see them pop up in the EU operation or in one of the NATO standing groups, which are active in the counter-piracy effort. There's no real political or practical factor other than, you know, you have a limited number of assets and you want them to be used by your allies in good cooperation with them in any useful and timely manner.
Eagle One.
Yeah, I guess my question is kind of roundabout, but when the European nations are looking at developing their navies, how much consideration, I know this is kind of a broad question, but how much consideration do they give to what the U.S. Navy is up to as to whether or not they need to work in the blue water area or whether a littoral force or how exactly are they looking at what the purpose of their navies?
I think it's very hard to give a blanket answer to that question because Europe has larger powers and smaller powers, larger ones being, of course, United Kingdom, France, and if you talk about naval matters, you need to think of countries like Spain and Italy. Here in the Netherlands, the latest trend has been one to change the Navy into a smaller but better equipped expeditionary force, which can operate anywhere in the world. At the same time, there is a tendency to pay more attention to littoral or brown water issues. In fact, just recently, a new class of Navy vessels, the Holland class, was launched, an ocean-going patrol vessel, which is typically one you would want to use in either counter-piracy or in brown water operations.
One thing I've noticed that has been an interesting trend, you look at the Danish Absalom class, and you also look at some of the effort to create underway replenishment ships. You have the French have a very nice command ship that they've come online here. So you have that contradictions where the navies are getting smaller, but when you back up and look at it from the point of view of trying to become, for lack of a better phrase, more useful and to be able to participate in international activities far away, but that is a much better use for the money, so to speak. And when you look at money in the European shipbuilding program, I think y'all have a habit of rolling your ships over faster than perhaps other nations do, where you will sell a ship that still has another 10 to 15 years of life on it. For instance, I believe the Netherlands transferred some of their older frigates to Belgium, and I think one of the Black Sea nations, former Soviet bloc. How much of your shipbuilding decisions are made in Europe, because you're relatively small countries, the Netherlands, 17 million, you have the Danes, 5.5 million, but you want to have your own indigenous shipbuilding program that's still viable and be able to build warships. Does that play a lot into your shipbuilding plans to keep that industrial infrastructure going?
Oh, absolutely. And you've seen in the past few years that the so-called Schelde-Damen, I should say, naval shipyards in Flushing and in other locations remains actively involved in building ships for the Navy. But you do see outsourcing of basic work in constructing naval vessels. For instance, the last big ships, landing platform docks they're called, the basics are built in Romania, and then the hulk, how you say it, the empty ship, so to speak, is towed to the Netherlands for finalization. And of course, there you have the specialized knowledge needed to build any naval platform, ranging from the electronics to engines, weapon systems, what have you, and there's a clear intent of any Dutch government, and we sort of change governments every 4 years, but there's a sort of continuity in keeping the knowledge in-house, so to speak, and not to buy abroad.
Did you have much of a challenge with the labor unions? Were you building in Romania and bringing here? Are the labor unions work a little closer with management to ensure the viability of the shipyard as an ongoing entity to keep the work going? Is there a good relationship with the labor unions and management?
Frankly speaking, I've never heard about any problem coming from the different unions. And also, you must understand that in the Netherlands we have military trade unions as well. And usually, when you know a labor issue is playing in the military fields, the military unions, and you have four of them, will usually be the first to raise the alert, so to speak. But there has never been any issue over building ships.
Eagle One.
Does the presence of a large and diverse naval force like the United States has allow the European navies, or the Dutch Navy in this case, to be a little more specialized in some of their ships, where they can create a vessel like it's a Danish ship, the Absalon or the Trump, which are different than the kind of warships the U.S. designs?
Well, obviously, you can't compare the two nations. The Netherlands has no ambition for a worldwide power projection. Within the alliance of NATO, we rely on the United States and, to a lesser extent, on countries like Britain, France, Spain, to take care of certain capabilities and certain kind of operations. And the same, of course, goes for issues like nuclear weapons. I mean, we don't have nuclear weapons. There are nuclear weapons based in the Netherlands, U.S. weapons, but which are intended for delivery by Dutch F-16 aircraft. But, you know, the Netherlands is not a big player in the oceans. Dutch Navy can project power. Interestingly enough, it held quite a big exercise, international exercise, including U.S. naval assets in the Caribbean back in 2006, and it was right after President Chavez of Venezuela said some nasty, interesting things about the Dutch Antilles nearby the Venezuelan coast, and the Netherlands demonstrated that it could very quickly rally a joint and combined force, including Dutch air assets, U.S. naval power, Dutch naval power. The French were there, the Belgians were there. So in working in coalitions, Dutch can hope to achieve what they would like to achieve, but they could never even dream of approaching naval capabilities like the ones that the U.S. has.
I know the Dutch were involved in coordinated and combined operations at sea before the U.S. was even a nation. But, you look at the beginnings of World War II, when the lost fleet, the Asiatic fleet of the Americans, the British, the Dutch, and the Australians just got destroyed at the outset of the war. When we had to get together and work in a multilateral environment, it wasn't as much of a challenge from a technology point of view, because signal flags are signal flags. You get your code books and going. But I know one of the ongoing challenges in Allied Command Transportation and Allied Command Transformation over in Norfolk has a point on this, was to ensure our compatibility at sea as technology develops quickly, whether we're talking about how we get our communications, how our codes work together, how our link systems interact, so we can plug in right there very, very fast. From the European point of view, are we getting better, maybe that is, for making sure when we develop new technology and new ways of communicating or providing tactical information, that we make sure that we do it in a manner that we can quickly integrate our allies and other fleets? Or is there a frustration there from Europe that they aren't able to fully integrate because we keep adopting things without integrating them?
Well, there are two things I would like to say on this particular issue. One is the capability question, and I find this very interesting example where the Dutch have fitted out their Zeven-Provincian class frigates, of which Trump is one, with the Smart L radar developed by Thales. And there was an interesting test, I think it was 2 years ago, near Hawaii, and it showed that the Thales radar could calculate a firing solution to hit a dummy warhead coming in from space, but the Dutch frigate didn't have the missile to shoot that warhead down. So what happened was that the Dutch calculated the firing solution, and a U.S. ship fired the missile and effectively destroyed the warhead in this particular test. On the other issue of communications, what I found refreshing to see when I visited the operation, the counter-piracy operation going on in the Gulf of Aden and in the wider Indian Ocean, was to see that the EU, the European Union, set up a secure chat channel, you might call it, called Mercury, in which all nations involved in counter-piracy can exchange tactical information, or even practical information for that matter, in real time. And you see some odd bedfellows there, because there's not only NATO and the EU fighting piracy, but there's also the Chinese Navy, the Russian Navy, Japanese Navy, South Korean Navy, what have you. And it's interesting to see then that with very little red tape, you get an instrument, this instrument Mercury, this chat channel, working and being operational and giving commanders much better situational awareness, and also makes it much easier to decide, which assets should be directed where. And another thing on this counter-piracy coalition of the willing, if you wish, is that there's no central command and control. Instead, there are monthly meetings in Bahrain of a what's called SHADE, Shared Awareness and Deconflictation. Well, I think the word says it. And there, too, you have the Chinese sitting in, NATO, U.S. Fifth Fleet, all the different task forces. And that I find an interesting development.
Eagle One.
Yeah, were you familiar before you did the exercise with the pirates down in off Somalia with the Naval Control and Guidance for Shipping program? It's a long-standing NATO program, which I think a lot of the things you're talking about seem to have spun off out of that.
Yeah, no doubt. I have no doubt in my mind that the idea of Mercury did not come out of a European Commission directive drafted in Brussels. And this comes back to what we said earlier, that many of the, or most of the European nations participating in a EU operation will half a year later participate in a NATO-led operation, or be part of the combined maritime forces led by the U.S. So communications and interchangeability and I think it's there already.
Yeah, I know years ago when I used to work in the NCAGs or NCSO programs, we used to call it the Brits and the Dutch and a lot of other countries were involved, and it did help our communications quite a bit on working around the merchant ship issues, and especially in dealing with sea lines of communication.
Yeah, well, in the case of the Somalian pirate problem, the solution is very simple. Merchant vessels use Channel 16, you know, the well-known channel on shipping radio. But they can also use the data which either EU or NATO provides to them. And there's a separate Maritime Security Center, Horn of Africa, which is actually based in Northwood, where both the NATO and EU naval commands are. And they are encouraged to register with MSC HOA if they want to transit the Gulf of Aden through a established internationally recommended transit corridor. So communications are there. Frankly, I've been covering multilateral operations in other occasions in former Yugoslavia, in Afghanistan. I followed what happened in Iraq, and this counter-piracy operation is refreshing in its simplicity and well, the lack of red tape to a certain extent. And as one Dutch Navy commander told me, well, he said, Hans, it's very simple. You know, once you're at sea, you talk to other colleagues from different navies. You can make agreements between, you know, the two of you, and things work that way. And if they, you know, if they work, they work, and by definition, they're thereby good. So life at sea appears to be somewhat more simple than on the ground.
It doesn't really apply to the Dutch. I mean, like we saw with the Dutch ground forces in Afghanistan, when the Netherlands commits itself, it usually does so just like you would see with the Brits, where they go forward relatively caveat-free compared to some of their continental allies. When you were off the coast of Somalia, the former commander of CTF 150 out there made a comment about 6 weeks ago that of the 25 ships that he had, he only had three or four that he could actually use fully in the counter-piracy manner to actually go after pirates and to take them. How do you have that? How do you deal with that challenge, or how did you see that challenge of certain Navy ships could not be fully utilized where other nations were?
I have not heard of any particularly important caveats, and Combined Task Force 150 is not the one active in the counter-piracy operation. That's 151, and that usually is only 4 to 5 ships strong and has some maritime aircraft, patrol aircraft assets. In general, I mean, in any multilateral operation, you have caveats. And, you know, commanders at the top will have a list of, you know, kind of operations they want to do, and then check them off with the national caveats of the participating nations. And, of course, those caveats, nasty as they may be at times, or annoying or ineffective, they do reflect the fact that all Western military alliances, be they NATO or EU or otherwise, are alliances of sovereign nations. And in all cases, national governments and parliaments will have a last say of, you know, how their military forces are being used within an alliance. It's not the ideal world, but you know, sovereignty is an important thing for many nations, and that can create a problem. But having said that, I specifically asked the commander of the EU naval force leading Operation Atalanta, and he told me bluntly that there was not a single caveat in his fleet which would impede any of the operations he would like to undertake.
Before the show started, we were talking briefly about the time that you spent underway with the Dutch Navy, and very frustrating for you, I know, is right after you left, they managed to detain 13 pirates. And if memory serves me right, that was a mild crisis because the crew thought they were going to be home for Christmas, But there was some question, okay, we have these pirates now. What do we do with them? How did that work out for the Dutch and also for the pirates they had captured?
Well, in the end, they sent the pirates home. Or rather, they put them in their mother's skiff with enough fuel, water to reach Somalia. The problem being that no country was willing to put these pirates on trial. And this is a recurring problem. Just the other day, there was an attack on a ship which regularly visits the port of Mogadishu, the Almanzan. There was an attempted hijack, and it was initially repelled by armed guards on board of the ship. And then the pirates came back, and the Vessel Protection Detachment, this time apparently, killed one of the attacking pirates. Shortly afterwards, a Spanish frigate arrested them. And this was a clear-cut case for any court, you would say. But what did the master of the Almanzan say? No, I'm not willing to testify in any court against these pirates. End of the case. So the pirates were sent home. And this is a recurring problem.
Eagle One.
If you were to give a message to the U.S. Navy in working with international forces, what message would you give?
I don't believe I'm in the position to give the U.S. Navy any message. Like I said, it's incomparable to ours, both in size and capabilities. The Netherlands, as far as I can see it as a journalist, is doing fine in U.S.-led operations, and U.S. ships are doing fine in NATO-led operations. So I don't really think there's any message to give. I mean, the world is what it is, and navies are what they are, and I think everybody is happy with that. Having said that, if you ask any military commander, could you use more and more capable assets? He said, sure we could. For instance, in the case of counter-piracy, there's a great shortage of long-range maritime patrol aircraft. But those have to be delivered by NATO or EU member states. If they don't come up with enough Orions to cover the wider Indian Oceans, well, you have to make do with the assets that you do have.
And the Netherlands sold their P-3s to the Germans about 5 years ago, so I guess that took the Dutch out of the equation for that.
Absolutely. At the time, the government of the day thought that they were no longer needed because no Russian submarines were appearing in the North Sea anymore. It only proves to show that when planning your military or your future military capabilities, you must reckon with scenarios which at the moment of decision making might not seem very likely or urgent. But it happens the other way around too. I've been to Afghanistan a couple of times and I heard the Canadians complaining about their lack of Chinook transport helicopters. Well, guess to who they sold their Chinooks? They sold them to the Netherlands.
We've one thing we've talked a fair bit about on our blog is the fact that history is a very jealous mistress. She will constantly remind you when she is not being paid close enough attention to. Yeah, the Chinooks and medium and heavy lift helicopter for everybody in Afghanistan have been a huge issue. You know, you go down to Kandahar and you see Jingle Air for all those old Soviet helicopters, civilian contracts. Now, you mentioned the Canadians. They were within a year of getting rid of all their armor. And then all of a sudden, when they found themselves in Kandahar, they said, hey, this tank, it's a pretty neat thing. And they wound it up, I believe they bought or leased some Dutch Leopard 2s after they decided their Leopard 1s weren't good enough. And now they're keeping armor for good.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was German ones they leased. Like we, once having boots on the ground in Afghanistan, Dutch Defense Ministry suddenly had to face the fact that the Dutch Army didn't really have IED-proof vehicles. So we very rapidly bought quite a few of those from the Australians.
Yeah, and Hans, we have used up our allotted time for you this evening. I wanted to thank you again for dialing in from Central European time to join us here on MIDRATS. It's been great to get a European perspective on that. And I wanted to make one more offer for everybody. Go to Radio Netherlands Worldwide and look up Hans up there. Look at the work he's provided. Bookmark their English language site and add that to your morning scans. Hans, say hi to everybody there in the Benelux force, and thanks again for coming on MIDRATS.
Well, I was glad to be a guest. Thanks a lot.
Yes, sir.